The chair recognizes the Honorable Genevieve Blatt, Democratic candidate for United States Senator, and the next United States Senator from the great state of Pennsylvania.
Mr. Speaker, fellow delegates, fellow Americans, we all love and admired President Kennedy, and he shared our love and admiration for another great American, a woman whose memory will be recalled for us tonight by a man who speaks more clearly in her spirit than any other voice in this world, our distinguished ambassador to the United Nations, the Honorable Adlai E. Stevenson.
Mr. Chairman, fellow delegates and friends, I thank you for your welcome, for all of your loyalty and comfort to me in years past, when our party's fortunes were not as bright as they are tonight. I have been proud to march with you in 7 presidential campaigns. And to have led 2 of them. But I have never been prouder than I am here tonight to follow 2 such brilliant and bold leaders and 2 such old and dear friends as Lyndon Johnson and Hubert Humphrey. They will, I predict, leave the future of our country and of the world in their debt. We have seen a remarkable documentary history of an extraordinary life. And it is of another noble American that I am commissioned to speak to you here tonight. She has passed beyond these voices, but our memory and her meaning have not. Eleanor Roosevelt. She was a lady. She was a lady for all seasons. And like her husband, she left a name to shine on the entablatures of truth forever. There are times when nations or movements or great political parties are sustained in their purposes in being by the persuasive unconscious influence of a few great men and women. Can we doubt that John Kennedy was one? Can we doubt that Eleanor Roosevelt had in some measure the keeping of the party's conscience in her special care? That her standards and integrity steadied our own. That her judgment persuaded the doubters and too soon despairers. That her will stiffened the waverers and encouraged the strong. I don't suggest some unworldly saint dwelling in remote regions of unsullied idealism. On the contrary, as we all know, Eleanor Roosevelt was a fighter, at her best down in the arena, face to face with opponents and ideas that she disapproved. Like that other grand old veteran of so many Democratic wars, Herbert Lehman of New York. In ripe old age, she took on tasks that might have daunted people half her age. Whether it was communist bosses in the United Nations, whether it was exploiters of the poor, or traducers of the faith of freedom, she sailed in tall and courteous, good-tempered, implacable, and thwacked them with the dispassionate energy of a good mother chastising a bad boy. She didn't carry our conscience by remote control. It was precisely her involvement that gave her such tremendous influence. Long before civil rights moved to the forefront of the nation's consciousness, she was there, quietly reminding us of the inequalities practiced in our land. Throughout the Depression, her patient journeys brought to the president and dramatized for the nation the misery and the neglect of millions. During the gray days of national peril, she heartened the wounded and the weary. And during the affluent 50s, when misery ran for cover before the national complacency, she never ceased to remind us of the slums, disease, deprivation, which still make up the dark face of this shining American planet. And again, when we emerged from the war, blinking and surprised to the role of world leadership, there she was, at the center of the effort, reminding her countrymen of their duties as citizens of the greater society of man. She thought of herself as an ugly duckling, but she walked in beauty in the ghettos of the world, bringing with her the reminder of her beloved Saint Francis. It is in the giving that we receive. And wherever she walked, beauty was forever there. There are always in any society, as there are in ours at this moment, plenty of men and women who would like, despite Abraham Lincoln's warning, to escape history, to evade the fiery trial, to turn back the clock. Eleanor Roosevelt never would and never did. She trained herself from the beginning of her life to face the realities, however unwelcome they might be. And face them she did, not only in the world around her, but in her own family and her own life. Few human beings are called upon to make decisions as difficult as some of hers. Fewer still, women in any case, have ever been subjected to personal abuse as malicious and persistent. But never did she hide, run, wince, or lower her head. Falsity withered in her presence. hypocrisy left the room. And never did she fail to act. If anything equaled the courage of her confrontation with the facts, it was the candor and the warmth of her response. She saw the state of our world as well as the most cynical, the most despairing, but she never despaired. She was never cynical. She never gave up. She believed in the human heart because she knew her own. And she proved by love that all the despair of a despairing time will never disprove, that hope is more powerful than fear. She has left us our counselor, our friend, our conscience. But there can be no doubt where she would be directing our great party today. She would bid us add to the equality we guarantee the extra dimension of opportunity without which even rights can seem much like emptiness. She would tell us to look at our great cities and ask whether in the midst of overwhelming affluence, can we afford such misery, such squalor, such hopelessness. She would tell us to labor on in the vineyards of the world, to succor the needy, to underpin the rule of law, to check aggression, and with remorseless purpose to seek peace among the nations of the world. She would ask us to engage ourselves profoundly in the war on poverty at home and abroad. She would urge us to build the great society, not only for America, but for all God's children. She would bid us do all this, not from party spirit, or partisan prejudice, or anger, or bitterness, or fear, or contempt. She would ask only for the positive emotions, love of one's unfortunate neighbor, since there but for the grace of God go I. Love of our party as a mighty engine of social betterment. Love for a world community threatened by the same annihilation, and above all, love for America, which our founding fathers first dedicated to the great propositions of freedom and equality and happiness, and which can never fulfill itself until these magnificent promises can be turned into even more magnificent facts. This is the spirit in which she would have us go out to join the everlasting battle for something better. This, my friends, is her lasting legacy to humankind and to the party she loved and worked for all of her life.
The people of the great state of Indiana have sent to the halls of Congress a truly great member of the United States Senate. The chair recognizes that distinguished member, the Honorable Vance Hotke of Indiana.
Mr. Chairman, delegates, ladies and gentlemen, it is my high honor this evening to introduce to you the architect who helped to bring to power the progressive administration of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He was a great Postmaster General and a great and a successful party chairman. I called before this convention a man of whom it has been said that he never forgets a name. And I say to you tonight, he is a man whose name Democrats will never forget, Mr. James A. Farley of New York.
Mr. Farley told us the other night, you may remember, that this is his 11th convention.
Senator Harkey, Speaker McCormick, members of the religious, ladies and gentlemen of this convention, and my fellow Americans, Congress of the United States, the mighty structure of American liberty. Neither our country nor any country, neither the American people nor any other people can call themselves free unless there is an open legislature, parliament, where the will of the people can be enacted into law. Indeed, the Congress of the United States is literally freedom in action. In this 20th century, two great men prided themselves on being men of the House, Sir Winston Churchill and Speaker Sam Rayburn. Their accomplishments are such that the 20th century histories of their countries and the laws they sponsored are almost biographies of their lives. In his various capacities, Speaker Sam Rayburn caused to be enacted into law more than 100 pieces of legislation. Today, they are the guidelines of every American's daily life. They range from rural electrification and collective bargain to security regulations and social security. These laws, I know, he believed to memorialize his life and his monument. No one of them has been repealed, and on the contrary, every one of them has been expanded. Since both major parties have embraced their principles in their platforms, they are now the dynamic force in the expanding American way of life. Speaker Sam Rayburn believed, as Pericles and Sir Winston Churchill, that the only victory is in persuasion. And no man in its long history has carried more weight of persuasion in the Congress than did Sam Rayburn. When he spoke, members of the House not only heard, they listened. They listened not because he aroused them with dramatic oratory, nor even because he compelled them with his flawless logic. They followed him because they trusted him. They accepted his leadership because he moved them as a sincere, knowledgeable captain of soundest judgment. An exalted and yet practical man who truly knew whereof he spoke. And he spoke only whereof he knew. The breadth of his vision was matched by the depth of his integrity. He was a Texan, and in the Texas tradition, his word was his bond. I have mentioned that more than 100 basic laws because I know that it is for them. He would like you to remember him. And so I ask you to recall that in large part, because of Sam Rayburn, the hard-earned savings of the American people are no longer the subject of heartless market manipulation. They are guarded by the Securities and Exchange Commission. Because of Sam Rayburn, the small deposits of the tens of millions of American working people are no longer in danger of any bank failure. They are protected by the insurance of the United States government. Because of Sam Rayburn and the late Senator Robert F. Wagner, an individual American need no longer stand helpless in the marketplace, forced to sell his labor as a commodity. He has the protection of collective bargaining. Because of Sam Rayburn, there has been incorporated into the laws of this land the fifth commandment of the laws of God. Honor thy father and thy mother, that the days may be long upon the land. No longer does our nation turn its back on the men and women who are too old to work. Social Security protects their age and also their self-respect. This is not only a matter of nation's laws, but because of Speaker Sam Rayburn, it is now a part of the nation's conscience. I have known three generations of great Americans from Texas. I know that if Speaker Sam Rayburn were here tonight, he would unhesitatingly say that much of what he accomplished he owed to his great teacher, Speaker of the House, Vice President of the United States, John Nance Garner, who brought him by in the ways of the Congress. And presumptuous as it may seem, I most earnestly believe that the President of the United States would be the first to say that for much of his effectiveness, he is indebted to the instruction and advice of Speaker Sam Rayburn. As a Democrat and as an American, I am thankful to God the President of the United States is the representative of that great tradition. Because of the precepts of Speaker Sam Rayburn, the nation and the whole world could not be more knowledgeable, more courageous, nor more honorable hands. There is the one single act of legislation, however, which to me especially hallows the name of Sam Rayburn. Because of his tremendous efforts, it is now the law of our land that children may no longer be compelled to spend the precious hours of childhood at hard work. No longer are little girls in the mills and little boys in the mines part of our national economy. Because of Sam Rayburn, they have been elected to the proper place, the single great asset of our national treasure. By his leadership in the House, Speaker Sam Rayburn wrote the Emancipation Proclamation for American Childhood, a law which, in my opinion, gives more freedom to more children, boys and girls, without regard to race, creed, or color, than any document in recorded history. Suffer little children to come unto me, said our Maker. And if this be the mightiest law of all, it is upon it that I commend my old friend to you, the American people, and to God, your faithful servant, Mr. Sam of Texas. Good luck and God bless you all.
Attorney General Kennedy, as you just saw, was in the presidential box with Mrs. Johnson. He is in the presidential box with Mrs. Johnson. Now the party has paid tribute to some of the great heroes in the Democratic pantheon. That part of the convention is over. Now there are some routine resolutions to be considered. During the, as we say, the Democratic Party's tribute to some of its fallen leaders is over now, and there are going to be some resolutions of thanks to various people who have helped organize and helped organize the convention for a few minutes. Then, shortly after that, Senator Humphrey will appear and make his acceptance speech, and then President Johnson will appear and make his. During the speech by Attorney General Kennedy, as I think you said, Chet, the ovation lasted 12 minutes and might have lasted longer if he hadn't stopped it. He mentioned, among other things, Mr. Kennedy's, the late Mr. Kennedy's devotion to Thomas Jefferson, which reminded me of one of his, one of the phrases, elegant phrases he was capable of. One night he had a dinner at the White House for Nobel Prize winners, poets, artists, scientists, all kinds of skilled and able scholarly people. And after dinner, he made a little talk, about 5 minutes, in which he said, this is the greatest assemblage of talent ever gathered in this room, except for those nights when Thomas Jefferson dined here alone. And Jim Farley, one of the great old faces in the Democratic Party, or great faces. Mr. Johnson has now entered the hall, has entered the presidential box. We found Attorney General and Mrs. Kennedy, Mrs. Johnson, Mrs. Humphrey. Kennedy's rather graciously moved over toward the back side of the box. They have been sitting up forward. They have stepped over to the back. Of course, as everyone must know by now, is Hello Dolly magically transformed into Hello Linda. Apparently doesn't take president too seriously. I can't remember a nominee putting him in his appearance prior to his acceptance speech.
There's another interesting little thing that just happened in the box. He turned around and waved to the Attorney General and Mrs. Kennedy to come back up to the front row, and they did.
Regret we couldn't hear that.
That's the birthday cake that's waiting for him out in front of Convention Hall, out on the boardwalk. And that's just the beginning of the planned events outside. There are going to be fireworks. I saw a list here. It's quite lengthy.
Oh, there's an elaborate ceremony planned. Parades, bands, 300 musicians, fireworks. We'll cover all that when it happens. The president is looking at his watch. Holding it out toward the, holding his watch out toward the audience, indicating you should sit down and be quiet and let us get on with the business. Senator Magnuson of Washington calls Prosper.
First, David, for a man to be given the nomination for the presidency of the United States for his birthday.
Suppose there's anybody on earth, from president on down, who doesn't feel awkward and self-conscious in the middle of the singing of Happy Birthday? I doubt it.
When we get him on this rostrum to give his great address.
Continue in a moment. First, we pause for station identification. NBC's Wallace Westfeld says the Freedom Democratic delegation from Mississippi has called on President Johnson to set up what it calls a protection bureau to assure the safety of its members when they return home. The letter was mailed to the White House today. It says most of the delegates in the biracial group, before they came here, were given warnings not to return after the convention. Now to the rostrum. Senator Magnuson has just introduced Senator Hubert Humphrey.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. President, my fellow Democrats, my fellow Americans, I proudly and humbly accept your nomination. Will we ever be able to forget this unbelievable, this moving, this beautiful, this wonderful evening? What a challenge to every person in this land to live up to the goals and the ideals of those who have gone before us and have charted the course of our action. I was deeply moved last night. I received a singular tribute from a friend and a great president, a tribute that I shall never forget. And I pray to Almighty God that I shall have the strength and the wisdom to measure up to the confidence and the trust that has been placed in me. And please let me say thank you, my fellow Democrats. I believe that I know President Johnson as well as any man. So let me tell you about him. I have known for 16 years his courage, his wisdom, his tact, and his persuasion, his judgment, and his leadership. But I shall never forget those hours and those days of tragedy and crisis last November that we once again relived tonight, when a dear and wonderful friend and a great president was taken from us and another stepped forward without a falter, without a moment of hesitation or a moment of doubt. I was among those that he called to his side. He asked us, we the people, Republicans and Democrats alike, Americans all, for our help. And I say, thank God that John Fitzgerald Kennedy was the patriot that he was, that he had the foresight that day in Los Angeles to provide for his country. And thank God for this country and for the peace of the world, that President Kennedy had the wisdom to choose a Lyndon Johnson as his vice president. I'm sure you remember these words, "Let us continue." Those simple and direct words of President Johnson reached the hearts of our people. Those words rallied them, lifted them, and unified them. In this world, disaster is ever but a step away. There is no margin for error. The leader of the free world, the leader of American democracy, holds in his hands the destinies not only of his own people, but holds in his hands the destinies of all mankind. Yes, yes, the President of the United States must be a man of calm and deep assurance, who knows his country and who knows his people. Above all, he must be a man of clear mind and of sound judgment, and a man who can lead, a man who can decide, a man of purpose and conviction. And Lyndon Johnson is that man. He is a man with the instincts of the teacher, who would rather persuade than to compel, who would rather unite than divide. President Johnson is respectful of the traditions of the presidency, and he understands the compelling need for restraint in the use of the greatest power ever assembled by man. In President Johnson's hands, our people know that our power is for justice. In his hands, our people know that our power is for peace.
And in his hands, our people know that our power is for freedom. President Johnson has helped to make the Democratic Party the only truly national party. And this very convention demonstrates our strong and our abiding unity and brotherhood. And what a contrast with the shambles at the Cow Palace in San Francisco. What a contrast with that incredible spectacle of bitterness, of hostility, of personal attack. The American people have seen the contrast. The American people do have a clear choice, and I predict their choice will be Lyndon Johnson in November. Ralph Waldo Emerson once spoke of the two parties which divide the state. The party of hope, my fellow Democrats, and the party of memory. They renew their rivalry, he said, from generation to generation. This contest between the party of hope and the party of memory lies at the very heart of this coming campaign. During the last few weeks, shrill voices have tried to lay claim to the great spirit of the American past, but they long for a past that never was. In their recklessness, in their radicalism, they distort the American conservative tradition. Yes, those who have kidnapped the Republican Party have made it this year not a party of memory and sentiment, but one of stridency, of unrestrained passion, of extreme and radical language. And by contrast, which is clear to all, under the leadership of President Lyndon Johnson, the Democratic Party stands today as the champion of great causes, as the party of purpose and conviction, as the party of national unity, and as the party of hope for all of mankind. Now let me document my case. Above all, the contrast between the Democratic leadership and that of the Goldwater Party is sharp and decisive on the question of peace and security. For 25 years, my fellow Americans, both parties have held the conviction that politics should stop at the water's edge, that we must be united in the face of our enemies, and we must be united in support of our allies and our friends. And I say here tonight to every American, to every friend of freedom, woe to that party or that spokesman that turns its back upon bipartisan foreign policy. Woe to those who are willing to divide this nation, and beware of those who cast false doubts upon our great strengths. What great problems there are to solve. Problems to control the awesome power of the nuclear age, to strengthen the Grand Alliance with Europe, to continue the task of building a strong and prosperous and united hemisphere under the Alliance for Progress, to assist our friends in Asia and Africa in preserving their freedom and promoting their progress, and to defend and extend freedom throughout the world. Now, my fellow Americans, these urgent problems demand reasoned solutions, not empty slogans. Childlike answers cannot solve man-sized problems. These problems demand leadership that is prudent, restrained, responsible. They require a president who knows that Rome was not built in a day, but who also knows that the great edifice of Western civilization can be brought down in ruins in 1 hour. The American presidency is not a place for a man who is impetuous at one moment and indecisive the next. Nor is it a place for one who is violently for something one day and violently opposed to it on the next. Nor is it an office where statements on matters of major policy are so confusing and so contradictory that neither friend nor foe knows where he stands. And my fellow Americans, it is of the highest importance that both friend and foe know that the American president means what he says and says what he means. The temporary spokesman of the Republican Party Yes, the temporary Republican spokesman is not only out of tune with the great majority of his countrymen, he is even out of step with his own party. In the last 3.5 years, most Democrats and Republicans have agreed on the great decisions our nation has made. But not the Republican spokesman, not Senator Goldwater. He's been facing backward against the mainstream of American history. Most Democrats and most Republicans in the United States Senate, for example, voted for the nuclear test ban treaty, but not the temporary Republican spokesman. Most Democrats and Republicans in the Senate voted for an $11.5 billion tax cut for American citizens and American business, but not Senator Goldwater. Most Democrats and Republicans in the Senate, in fact, 4/5 of the members of his own party, voted for the Civil Rights Act, but not Senator Goldwater. Most Democrats and Republicans in the Senate voted for the establishment of the United States Arms Control and Disarmament Agency that seeks to slow down the nuclear arms race among the nations, but not the temporary Republican spokesman. Most Democrats and most Republicans in the Senate voted last year for an expanded medical education program, but not Senator Goldwater. Most Democrats and most Republicans in the Senate voted for education legislation, but not Senator Goldwater. Most Democrats and most Republicans in the Senate voted for the National Defense Education Act, but not the temporary. And my fellow Americans, most Democrats and most Republicans in the Senate voted to help the United Nations in its peacekeeping functions when it was in financial difficulty, but not Senator Goldwater. Yes, my fellow Americans, it is a fact that the temporary Republican spokesman is not in the mainstream of his party. In fact, he has not even touched the shore. Now, I believe in the two-party system, but there must be two responsible parties. And there must be men who are equipped to lead a great nation as the standard bearers of the two parties. It is imperative that the leadership of the great parties move within the mainstream of American thought and philosophy. I pledge to this convention, I pledge to our great president, to all the American people, my complete devotion to this task, to prove once again that the Democratic Party deserves America's affections and that we are indeed the party of hope for the American people. So tonight, let us here and now pledge that the campaign that we will wage will be worthy of our great President Johnson. And my fellow Americans, let us hereby resolve and pledge tonight that that campaign will be worthy of the memory of the late and beloved President John Fitzgerald Kennedy. While others may appeal to passions and prejudice and appeal to fear and bitterness, we of the Democratic Party call upon all Americans to join us in making our country a land of opportunity for our young, a home of security and dignity for our elderly, and a place of compassion and care for our afflicted. I say to those responsible and forward-looking Republicans who put our country above their party, and there are thousands of them, we welcome you to the banner of Lyndon Baines Johnson. We welcome your support. Yes. Yes, we extend the hand of fellowship. We ask you to join us tonight. For this president, my fellow Americans, is the president of all of the American people. He is the president in the great American tradition for labor and for business. No class conflict for the farm family that will receive the unending attention and care of this president and for the city worker, for North and for the South, for East and for the West. This is our president. President Lyndon Johnson represents, in fact, he is the embodiment of the spirit of national unity, the embodiment of national purpose, the man in whose hands we place our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. I am proud to be the friend of this great president, and I am very proud that he has asked this convention to select me as his running mate. My fellow Americans, I ask you to walk with us, to work with us, to march forward with us, to help President Johnson build the great society for America of the future. Yes, let us continue. Let us, fellow Democrats and fellow Americans, let us go forward. Let us take those giant steps forward to which the president has called us, to end the shame of poverty, to end the injustice and prejudice and the denial of opportunity, to build the great society and to secure the freedom of man and the peace of the world. We can do no less. And to this tonight, let us resolve to pledge our every effort. Thank you.
I should think that the vice presidential nominee might merit an A on that performance, because by virtue of the film, the Kennedy film, this audience had been rather emotionally wrung out, and it was his task to transform the atmosphere and the climate.
Demonstration on the floor following Senator Humphrey's speech. We'll return to the convention hall in a moment. Now a pause for station identification.
Good evening.
Wonder what he meant by that. Perhaps he'll tell us Mondays this fall on NBC.
Meet Tab, a one-calorie soft drink that doesn't taste like one.
Taste the robust flavor of Tab today. Taste the robust flavor of Tab today. The Coca-Cola Company puts the robust flavor in Tab.
Join 400 outstanding high school students on the campus of Salem College in Winston-Salem as they participate in an experiment in excellence. See the operation of the North Carolina Governor School Sunday evening at 8:30 on Channel 12.
WSJS Television 12.
News continues its coverage of the Democratic National Convention, brought to you by the Gulf Oil Corporation.
What's happening now on the rostrum is that the chairman is appointing a committee, a ceremonial committee, to escort President Johnson to the rostrum to make his acceptance speech. So let's go down now to the rostrum.
Illinois. Congressman Al Ullman of Oregon. Congressman Neil Smith of Iowa. This is Jerry Joseph of Minnesota. Honorable Hewlett Smith, Democratic nominee for governor of West Virginia. Honorable Sam Gardner, Democratic nominee for governor of Arizona. The Honorable Douglas Wynn of Mississippi. The chair takes this opportunity of calling to the attention of this great convention that the chairman of the committee, Carl Vinson, has served the longest of any man in the history of our country in the House of Representatives, one of the great Americans of all time, and the country is indebted to him more. No one is more indebted to the country than the country is no more indebted to anyone than Carl Vinson for the great, powerful military force that we have today. I now read a telegram addressed to me. My heartiest greetings to my fellow Democrats. You are having a great convention, and you have produced a great ticket. Johnson and Humphrey are unbeatable. During the campaign, my services are available whenever possible. Harry S. Truman.